Governor Rick Scott signs into law a new standard for testing rape kits. We'll tell you about it in just a moment. And good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Well, the show's always live at 9, and you can also now watch the show every day at our partner's website, tvjax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on a new law in Florida requiring faster responses to reports of rape, and why some women say they're still skeptical it will bring their rapists to justice. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, marking Women's History Month with a look at one of the most fascinating attractions in St. Augustine, the Jimenez Fatio House. And the big band sound of the Jensen Sisters, that's later. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Governor Rick Scott has signed into law a measure requiring all rape kits in the state to be tested within 120 days. This in the wake of reports that 13,000 kits around Florida have been sitting around on shelves, unprocessed, sometimes for years. Now, here in Duval County, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement reports one of the highest rates of forcible sexual offenses in the state. Because of that, the state attorney's office has applied for a $2 million grant to handle all of the untested rape kits right here in our area. But even with this new law now taking effect in Florida, some women who've been victims of sexual assault say they're skeptical authorities can actually bring their cases to justice. On the phone right now, we welcome a local sexual assault survivor. Her name is Sarah. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Good to have you on the show. And in studio, Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth, who has written about Sarah's ordeal. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
And to our callers, what are your comments and questions about the new law involving rape kits in Florida? We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us. I know it's difficult to talk about this long ordeal you've been through. And it goes all the way back to May of 2001 in downtown Jacksonville when you were sexually assaulted. Can you tell us what happened after that?
Yes. After that, I went, after the ordeal, I went home and, I was contacted, or a detective came to the location where I was living at the time. And basically, he made it seem like, that it was my fault. He said that, we have video surveillance of the crime scene. If we find this guy and he tells us you traded him sex for drugs or alcohol, we are taking you to jail. I was distraught by hearing that. I told him to do whatever he needed to do with the case. And from there, I haven't heard anything from the police department, the detective, nobody. In 2014, I was contacted while visiting my parents there in Jacksonville. And I was contacted by a detective, and he said, we have found a suspect in your cold case leading back to 2001. Would you like to reopen the case? And I said yes. At that time, the case was reopened. The police department wanted to issue an arrest warrant for the perpetrator, the attacker, and the state attorney's office denied it. They said they were not prosecuting. They were not going to have this man arrested because it was basically my word against his due to his drug and prostitution background. And I said, well, did you look at my criminal background? I have no criminal background. And they said, yes, but it doesn't matter. We will not take a case to court if we know we cannot win.
Okay, and let's bring Claire Goforth into the discussion. For the record, the state attorney's office has officially denied that they wouldn't prosecute this case because of fears that they might lose. Claire Goforth, you have reported that the suspect in Sarah's case has been identified not once but twice with DNA evidence. That is what you need in a rape kit to get a conviction, usually.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, there's no question about his identity. And there's, you know, let's be clear about another thing about this case. They sent a older male detective to speak to a 20-year-old woman alone at her home the day after she'd been sexually assaulted. And in that conversation, he threatened to arrest her if she was lying. He lied about having video surveillance. There's nothing that I've seen in any of the information they have that indicates there was any surveillance. He essentially did what we would call, I don't like the term, but slut-shamed her, because it seems as though, you know, their opinion, his opinion, and what seems to be echoed by the state attorney's actions in this case is that because she made a poor choice by going off with a stranger, trusting the wrong man, that somehow she doesn't deserve a chance at justice, even though there have been two DNA matches. And as she said, there was that she has no criminal record. He has an extensive criminal record, this person. And here she is all these years later going through the same process again, fighting for justice and having the police department, let's be fair, the police department has really made an effort to bring her justice. And the state attorney's office isn't even going to give her the shot at trial.
And to be clear, when this first happened in 2001, the procedures that JSO undertook 15 years later, you reported their procedures have changed considerably when it comes to dealing with allegations of sexual assault and how victims are handled or people who say they've been attacked.
Yes, that's correct. They have also changed their policy for testing rape kits in cases such as Sarah's, where through under duress, she said, you do whatever you have to do. The detective took that to mean that it was okay to drop the case. Now they would still test that rape kit, regardless of the victim's desire to pursue justice.
And Sarah, what are your thoughts about this new law just signed by the governor that will require all rape kits in Florida now to be tested within 120 days?
I think it's excellent, but they still cannot guarantee the victims any justice. They could not guarantee me justice. So for them to say, you know, well, we can give these victims justice, to me, that is false hope. It is good that they can get them tested within 120 days, but if they cannot help a victim, then don't give them false hope. You know, I kept fighting after they told me that they were not going to prosecute him. I kept fighting and fighting and fighting to the point where the police department actually made an arrest 2 weeks before Christmas of last year. And then 3 days before Christmas, Angela Corey's office called me and said, we are letting him go free. We will not prosecute him. We cannot.
And Jackie Bernard, the spokeswoman for the state attorney's office, told your publication that the reason for not proceeding with this case is that the state attorney's office didn't feel it could prove in court that it was not a consensual encounter, correct?
That is absolutely correct. The problem is that these cases very often come down to consent. And in that situation, the proof you have is the victim's testimony. In this case, Sarah is more than willing to get on the stand and tell her story. And I've sat across the table from her and listened to her story and seen her tears and felt her emotion. I have ultimate confidence that the jury would believe her just as much as I do. There's another piece to this law that will be interesting to see how it unfolds, because although it requires testing of all these kits within 120 days, what about the 13,000 that we already have? FDLE has only so many resources to test these. So
13,000 statewide and thousands in Northeast Florida alone, where we have a big issue with sexual assault. Lots of cases here.
Right. And even if by some miracle of resources we were able to test them all at once, we don't possibly have all the law enforcement resources to pursue prosecution in all the cases. So then you come up with a situation, I believe there's a time limit after a DNA match after which you can no longer pursue charges. So we may see cases that just never get brought to justice because of that time limit.
Let's go to your calls now about the new law in Florida requiring speedy testing of rape kits. As we speak to one woman who is trying to get her case prosecuted, Sarah on the line with us this morning, along with Claire Goforth of Folio, and it's 549-2937. Christine is on the south side. Hi, Christine. Thanks for calling. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on the phone.
Sure.
I work at a agency with sexual assault, and, you know, we're seeing a lot of women come in now that have these sex kits that are getting reopened, and I agree with the other caller or the lady that you have on the phone. A lot of the times it is the state attorney that kind of puts a halt to a lot of these cases, and even though they're denying, they're not taking them to court and seeking justice, really most of the time it is them pretty much afraid of losing the case or stating that we don't have enough evidence.
Okay, thanks for sharing that, Christine. Now, let's discuss the reasons why prosecutors might feel that they can't get a conviction in these cases. As you said, if it comes down to whether the jury believes there was consent, lawyers in court obviously feel like that's a high bar to prove sometimes.
It is, but that's their job, and that's what the justice system is set up to do, is to give everyone a chance.
Sarah, are you going to keep pressing to have your case prosecuted?
I was told that there is nothing else that could be done for me, but I'm not gonna. I'm not gonna keep fighting. That's why I'm on air today. You know, I wasn't sure if I was gonna do this or not from the, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and then I said, you know what, I'm not gonna let them get away with it. You know, they treated me so unfairly since 2001, and I'm not going to let them get away with hurting me. So I'm going to fight as hard as I can fight, but I was told that there is nothing else that they can do for me. Now, I was told by Angela Corey, if another sexual assault kit came up and it had this attacker's name to a different assault kit, would I be able to help another victim? I guess it's called the Williams Law.
Uh-huh.
I think, yeah. And I said, yes. I said, I don't mind helping other victims. I said, but what are you going to do for me? We can't do anything for you. It's your word against his. But they know this man, he has changed his story so many times that you know he's lying. And I never once since 2001 has my story ever changed. It's always remained the same.
Now, to be clear, there is more than her testimony, Sarah's testimony. The alleged perpetrator has been identified by DNA twice. Can you tell us about that, Claire?
Yes, originally I believe it was the test kit from the scene that came back and was that 2008. And then again, they've tested her kit in 2011, a different part of the evidence. And they both came back with a positive match. And yet it took 6 years from the original test, 3 years from the subsequent test for them to even give her the courtesy of a phone call.
And does that have something to do with the backlog? Because as we learned, there are nearly 4,000 unsolved or suspended sexual assault cases in Jacksonville. The state attorney's office has applied for a $2 million grant to try to reduce that backlog.
Yes, I mean, this wouldn't actually be part of the backlog of rape kits. It would be the backlog of rape cases.
Cases.
Right, and it sort of indicates perhaps a lack of priority on these cases.
Well, let's go to your calls on this. David on the north side. Go ahead, David. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. First of all, I'd like to say to the panelists, Sarah, you keep fighting. Don't let this thing go away. I think it's just a travesty. and I have a couple of questions that I'll take answers off the air on. Number one, what is it that causes the backlog? I mean, is it just a lack of resources? And why can't this be settled, or why can't this be handled on the local level? And why did it have to come from the state to in order to have a law enacted to make this happen? I mean, this is a travesty against women. Why are we having to go to such extremes to get these things done? I mean, Sarah's been suffering with this for almost a decade, it sounds like, and I just think that it's a travesty that we have to deal with it in this manner. But I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, David, thank you. Claire, how about you answer him first, and then we'll have Sarah.
Well, the reason that we needed state legislation is because our prosecutor hasn't been handling these cases the way they should be.
Prosecutors,
that's state, true.
Statewide, there's a backlog.
That's true. And locally, we also have an issue. And Angela Corey has said that she opposes this legislation because it mandates that we do our jobs. That's her words. If they had been doing their jobs all along, I don't think we'd need this legislation.
Well, she did apply for a $2 million grant to test the kit, or to clear the backlog.
Sure, but she proposes legislation that sets a time limit,
which is
what this legislation does.
Sarah, you're getting supportive calls from listeners, first off, which is gratifying. But what are your thoughts?
Yes, thank you. As far as the backlogs and the resources go, I don't know if it really has to do with funding or people just not wanting to do their job. Like Claire said earlier, there was two DNA hits. The first hit they had, I asked them, I said, why did y'all not contact me in 2008 when y'all had the first hit? I asked them, did y'all have a policy to contact victims when y'all have hits in their rape cases? And they said, yes, we had a policy to contact you. And I said, then why was I not contacted? And he said, the detective that came to you in 2001 said that you wanted the case closed. So that's why you were never contacted once we had a hit on the DNA.
And did you want it closed?
I never told the detective back in 2001 to close the case. I told him to do what he needed to do. And by that, he took it as I told him to close the case. And that never came out of my mouth.
Okay. If you could stand by 1 second, let me just get a few more questions on the air. Daryl in St. Augustine. Go ahead, Daryl. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so sorry, Sarah, and I'm truly sorry to the other 13,000 women who have been victims and been ignored. This seems to run throughout the justice system in this country, where there's a complete lack of accountability for your doing your job. For if any other industry ignored their job to the level of 13,000 things, people would be getting fired. But I don't hear any prosecutors going to jail for holding back evidence. I don't hear any detectives getting fired for not producing results. I don't hear anybody being held accountable for 13,000 disappearing rape kits. But the victims sit there in such a level of, you know, impotency. And the Justice Department sits there and says, well, I'm sorry, we just can't do anything. I'm sorry, but the Justice Department needs to begin to be held accountable and getting fired for not doing your job.
All right. Thanks for the call. Thanks, Daryl. And I understand completely the emotion around this case. To try to be even-handed, though, let me point out that there was a detective, one person you single out in your piece, Claire, Detective Cruz with the JSO, even though it was many years after Sarah's reported being raped, he did aggressively try to follow up a different detective. So I wanted to just make note of that.
Yes, I mean, he has done everything that he could by my view of the case. He has gone above and beyond the call of duty and done everything to try to get justice for her. Ultimately, that was not effective. And I believe that Sheriff Williams has also supported that effort.
And, you know, Sarah, as the caller pointed out, it's not as though Florida is the only state that has this type of issue with backlogs of rape. It's been reported extensively all over the country that this is a systemic issue in the system. And what do you think about the perception that, it's just perhaps due to old-fashioned sexism that these cases aren't taken as seriously as they should be and that women often aren't believed when they want to give their testimony?
You know, it's not just about women. It's about men and children as well, you know, because we have men and children that are raped every day as well, not just women. But I feel that women do get singled out more often, and we get, you know, portrayed as liars more than anything. You know, Angela Corey, I had a conference call with her a few months back, and I actually met with her. And for her to sit there and tell me that they can't do anything and then not speak to me ever since. She has not once picked up a phone call to see how I was doing. It's like I didn't matter after that conversation. You know what I'm saying? And I felt that if you handle every case to the fullest extent, then maybe you would be, to me, a better person. But you know, I feel that, you know, she's not taking me seriously. She's not taking victims seriously. I think she's focusing and putting her efforts into a lot of the wrong cases. And I asked her, I've asked all the other state attorneys throughout the process. If y'all do not want to take it in court because you think you cannot win a case, let me have my day in court. I told them, I said, I'm ready to let the jury decide my fate.
Okay.
Let me jump in.
And since no one from that office is here other than the official statements that we've noted, could there be any other circumstances around this case that haven't been revealed to the media or the public that could be affecting this decision?
I suppose there could be. I don't know what those are. And I do know, and Sarah, please correct me if I'm wrong, that in the context of the conversations that you've had with State Attorney Angela Corey since your case originally, I reported on your case originally, the goal of those conversations was to discourage her from doing further media. And they told her, and please, Sarah, do jump in if I'm incorrectly stating what they told you, that if she continued to talk to the media, it would make her chances at getting justice less likely. And here,
yes, that is correct.
So,
so you're saying you were told that by the office?
I was, by Angela Corey.
Yes, and Angela Corey sat, and Sarah, please correct me, sat across from her and cried and said she was so sorry, and yet there's nothing that she can do. I think that, you know, that office, they're acting as the judge, jury, and the jury in this case, and probably in a lot of other cases, because Sarah's not the only woman who contacted me with a story just like this to say they had had rape kit matches come back, they were never informed, and now they're not even getting a chance at justice.
Let's go to Yvonda on the south side. Go ahead, Yvonda.
Yes, I just want to extend my support to Sarah and her advocate there, and to say that, yes, I do think sexism plays a part, and sexism can also be engaged in by misinformed women. And it's very demeaning to women to know that, oh, we'll wait and see if another DNA hit comes up on this accused rapist before we take you seriously. Well, who out there would like their mother or sister or daughter to be that corroborating evidence? Sarah, stand strong.
Yeah, I mean,
thanks for the call.
We know that so many of these attackers, they're repeat offenders. They don't, it's not just a one-time deal with them. And because of the low number of women that are willing to, women, children, and men that are willing to report, something like 64% of rape cases are never reported, according to RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And according to their data, only 2% of rapists will spend a single day in jail for their crimes.
It's very low conviction rate. And to be clear, that's coast to coast. This is an issue all over the country, certainly not local, just local. Sarah, your final thoughts?
On the question you had a little while ago about was there anything else that was said that the media doesn't know about or other people don't know about? Yes, I was told something else that nobody knows about. And it is when they questioned him, he said, I told y'all last time, I do not know this woman. I've never had sex with this woman. This is BS. And then in a different interview, he said, what was it? He said to them, he says, well, back then I was on drugs really bad and I did prostitution. So I may have had sex with her in exchange for drugs. But he does have a criminal drug and prostitution background. He's been arrested 15 times. And I'm like, why isn't he in jail? And he was actually, he was out of jail, I think, for a day or two before he attacked me. So he had just got out of jail on bond 2 days before my attack. And they said because he made that statement about he may have had sex with me in exchange for drugs, that's why they cannot prosecute him because of his criminal background.
Okay. Well, I know it's difficult even after all these years to talk about, so I do appreciate you being on the program today to share your story. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. One more thing. Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
I know Mr. Wesley Wright, A while back, he brought up the untested kit, and that's how I actually contacted him, and then got in touch with Claire Goforth. And if it was not for him bringing up the issues on all the untested rape kits, I probably would not be on air today with y'all and fighting as hard as I've been fighting. And I just want to thank him and you and Claire so much for helping me get this out. And without y'all, I don't know what I would have done. So thank you all. And thank you, everybody, for your support.
Thank you. And you'll continue reporting on this, I guess?
Yes, of course. I'm always doing my best to report on the issues that are affecting our community. Sexual assault is unbelievably high in Duval County. Our rate is twice that of other counties that are urban, such as ours. The state attorney's office and the sheriff's office, they prefer to believe that our rate is increasing every year because there are more victims willing to report, not more rapes. But I don't think that that is accurate. I think that there are because of this lack of prosecution in cases like Sarah's, these repeat offenders are still out there. They're assaulting women and children. And we need to continue to focus on this issue as a community and try to bring these people to justice.
Well, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Melissa.
Yes.
Thanks so much. And much more still to come on the program. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
I'm Gail Sturman, and proud to be a member of WJCT's Board of Trustees. Can we shorten WJCT's spring fundraiser? Let's find out. It's time to give now. When we get to our goal of $80,000, the fundraiser ends. If this station is as important to you as it is to me, please join us. Donate now at WJCT.org.
Join WJCT for a special sneak preview of Ken Burns' Jackie Robinson documentary, Sunday, April 3rd, in the Virginia Room in the Ringhaver Student Center of Flagler College. The film depicts the life and accomplishments of baseball legend and civil rights pioneer Jack Roosevelt Robinson, who fearlessly crossed baseball's color line and continued fighting discrimination after his baseball career ended. Reception begins at 3 with screening and discussion to follow. This event is free, but registration is required. Info at WJCT.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, it's time to give if you're a fan of 89.9. WJCT's Spring Radio Pledge Drive is actually underway now, and we need you to help us hit our goal before April 8th. If you can give early and give generously, then that's less shows we have to interrupt. WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo is here to fill us in, and we're off to a good start.
Yeah, Melissa, we're trying something a little different this year. Normally at this time of year, we'd be gearing up for an entire week where we'd be constantly interrupting every single program that you hear on 89.9. So everything from Morning Edition all the way through the evening, you'd be hearing constant on-air pitches, people coming on live asking for money. So this year we're trying something called the non-pledge pledge. It's more radio, hashtag more radio. And we're trying to raise $80,000 by April 9th. So if we can do that, we are done. On April 9th, we will have no pledge drive. If we can't get quite to $80,000, we will have to come on air and do that regular pledge drive. So we're asking people to give right now on WJCT.org, hit support. We're also giving prizes every week during this non-pledge pledge. The first week, we've already given out an iPad to one of those lucky givers. This week, you can win a GoPro camera. Mm-hmm. And next week...
Not bad, not too shabby.
No. Next week, you can get a smartwatch. Who doesn't want a smartwatch? So every time you give, you are entered in those prize drawings. And the earlier you give, the greater chance you have to win.
And it's easy to do. Just go to WJCT.org, click that support tab right away. Or are we opening up the phone number already?
Yes, we
yes, 353-9528.
That's right.
To make your donation, get in the queue to win a GoPro. That's this week's prize. And the winner will be picked on Monday. And if you give now, then as Jessica said, that's less time we have to interrupt all your favorite shows, whether it's this show, Diane Rehm, Fresh Air, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, or weekend shows that you love. The more you give now, the less we have to do of that. And I know everybody likes to hear that. So go ahead and support us. It's time to give right now. As Jessica said, it's the non-pledge pledge drive. And hopefully it'll work so well, we'll do it this way every time. So thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Again, that's WJCT.org. Hit the support button. It's time to give. And we'll be right back.
WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through April 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Changes are coming to WJCT 89.9 FM April 1st. To find out how you can continue to listen to classical music 22 hours a day, please call 358-6390.
Welcome back. Well, the Jimenez Facio House Museum in St. Augustine is what we're going to talk about right now. It's a unique place, even in a city renowned for its fascinating historic sites. Now, the building itself was first erected in 1798. Then, when Florida became a territory in 1821, it was purchased over the decades by a series of women entrepreneurs. And they used their domestic skills to create an inn for visitors coming to St. Augustine. This was at a time when businesswomen had very few opportunities, but they were successful. And in fact, their idea of treating those staying in their establishment as welcomed guests is what helped create the tourism industry right here in Florida. It's Women's History Month, so we're putting the spotlight on the Jimenez Facio Museum right now as we welcome Susan Caven with the National Society of the Colonial Dames in the state of Florida. And you look like a great dame to me.
Well, thank you. You do. You look like a great dame to me, too.
That is just the best organization name I've ever heard in my life. Tell us how the National Society of the Colonial Dames, first bought this property back in the 30s, right?
Right.
To make a museum out of it.
Right. In fact, the National Society is 125 years old, and it was started to preserve the culture of the United States. And so they became very involved in historic preservation. And
right.
So the Dames of Florida bought the house in 1939. It was a wreck.
Oh, really?
And it was just a horror. But they saw it. They knew it was historic. They didn't know why, but they knew there was something about it. And it's interesting because the trend in the 1930s, they were just realizing you kept buildings, but you didn't restore them. That was a whole new concept. And Williamsburg was being restored by the Rockefellers at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And these women took a loan in the middle of the Depression, 1939, borrowed $10,000 to buy this wreck of a building.
Wow.
But there are three good things. They knew they didn't know what to do. They knew they didn't know really about the building. And they knew they had to find people who did. So they contacted Williamsburg people,
mm-hmm.
and got advice about what to do, and they took the advice. How about that?
Very nice. They took the advice.
Right.
How about it? So
I think the interesting thing about Women's History Month is these women in the 30s were on the forefront of preserving and restoring accurately a house, and the women in the 1830s didn't know that there was going to be a tourism business, but the trend.
But they created it in Florida.
They did it. They just were they were women. They solved problems.
And they saw the opportunity.
Yes.
Not only that, this house has been owned and managed by women ever since the early 1800s.
Operated by women.
That's unique, too.
That is totally unique.
And so when people go through the house, and by the way, it's just south of the downtown historic plaza on Aviles Street.
The oldest platted street in North America.
Right. So you, if you're looking at the plaza and you're standing in front of it and the water is behind you, you take a left.
Yeah. You go, it's to south of the plaza.
And so what do people see when they go through this?
The museum shows life. You get in a time capsule and you live life in the 1840s. And so every room has a story to tell about the people that live there. The thought of traveling for pleasure was completely unheard of worldwide. But in the 1830s, people kind of started thinking of doing that. So where are you going to stay? And these women realized this was an opportunity. And women in that time, we take such for granted. But if you're a married woman back then, you owned nothing,
mm-hmm.
not your hairpin, not any clothes. You owned nothing. But if you were unmarried, you could own property.
And these unmarried women were able to buy the property.
They were able to buy the property and operate a business.
How did they get the money to buy it? How did they?
Well, interestingly enough, the first woman was in her 20s, had been widowed twice.
Okay.
They moved to St. Augustine when we became a territory. Her husband bought some property and up and died on it, her second husband. And so there she
they
is.
They died earlier in those days.
Yeah, they did. And so she was a savvy woman and she had to make her own business. And she realized these people were coming down. Down to St. Augustine was this like going to the Mars. It had been owned by the Spanish and then the English and then the Spanish again for 300 years.
Yeah.
No one had been there.
So this is the first time Americans could come down to Florida.
Exactly. And the people that could come were people of means.
Mm-hmm.
And they were used to a certain way of living. And so these women were sophisticated. They were smart. They were well-educated. They were, Louisa Facio spoke four languages, but they weren't
married.
Was
she Spanish?
Nope. She was, her father was from Switzerland. He owned 10,000 acres of Northeast Florida and Switzerland, Florida. He named that. Because he liked Switzerland. He was from Switzerland.
Oh, no, now I know why that place is called that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
all
that
right.
was her father, but she never married. And the Indians burned down their plantation in Switzerland twice. So she couldn't stay there. They were land poor. She owned 10,000 acres, but, you know, she had to put food on her table. And so.
And boy, did she ever.
And did she. But they were sophisticated women. And they, so they welcomed these people as guests, which had never been done, not boarders. Because that's how they were. That's what they were. And that's what I think is cool, is that these women took their domestic skills. They took what they knew how to do and made a business. And there were a lot of things to figure out. This wasn't a home. So you have to have a lot of places, rooms for people to stay. You have to feed them.
Was it the first inn in St. Augustine?
Yeah, it was the first. They were.
The
it
very
was just
first.
Beginning. Yeah. And certainly there were other inns, but they were known as the best place to stay.
And by the way, TripAdvisor consistently rates the Jimenez Facio Museum as one of the best things to check out if you're
best
visiting
museum.
St. Augustine. And so this is a hidden gem that maybe isn't as hidden anymore because
exactly.
the word is really getting out
it is.
About this amazing property. Well, I can't believe in all the years I've lived here and all the times I've visited St. Augustine, Susan, I've never been, and I'm going to remedy that as soon as possible, because we still have a couple of days left in Women's History Month.
That's
so
right.
Go check it out this month or any month.
Exactly, and you'll love it. It is a trip through the 1800s, and you see the people that live there, the doctor and the sea captain, and so it is lovely. It's an amazing trip, and TripAdvisor just they go on and on about it. So, but Avila Street itself is a fabulous street. There are art galleries and there. Restaurants. I mean, it's a fabulous, the oldest street, and the city archaeologist in St. Augustine says that our museum is on the epicenter mm-hmm. of history of St. Augustine.
Check it out there as soon as you can. It is one of the incredible treasures of the nation's oldest city, the Jimenez Facio House Museum at 20 Avila Street in St. Augustine. Susan Caven with the Colonial Dames of
right.
Florida. By the way, that's a story in itself, which we'll have to have you back to talk about that another time.
Love to talk about it.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And in a moment, the big band sound of the Jensen Sisters. That's next.
Everyone creating their own life after 50. WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. Sponsored in part by AARP Real Possibilities.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls' Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, they are wonder artists from Canada bringing their original big band music to UNF this week. The Jensen Sisters will be in concert Thursday night at UNF's Robinson Theater. We're pleased to welcome Christine and Ingrid Jensen now as they've got a preview of the big show. Good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's exciting to have you both here. You're so renowned in the jazz world, and we'll listen to a little of your music in just a moment. Ingrid, you guys have played together all over the world. What's it like? And you perform independently of each other, but what's it like to perform together?
Family.
Family.
It's a lot of fun. We definitely have a lot of history, and there's a certain sense of intuitiveness that happens when two sisters play together that doesn't always happen with everyone else.
Now, I understand you're both from Vancouver Island, a town there that is also home to jazz icon Diana Krall. Is that right?
It is. We grew up listening to her and watching her move forward.
And was she an influence?
Definitely.
Yeah.
She helped bring in some great musicians into Nanaimo that spurred us into this. Hey, anybody can do this.
Yeah. And she was also playing like really hard and in a good way, like really strong piano when we were pretty young. So we got to see her as an instrumentalist as well.
And you and the two of you play saxophone and trumpet.
I play trumpet. Yeah. Chrissy plays sax.
Let's listen to a little bit now of the Jensen Sisters. Oh. We're having equipment trouble, but we'll try to unfreeze it while we keep talking to you.
We have a crash.
We'll fix it in a moment. You both are so renowned in the jazz world. For people that love jazz, they'll know your names in a minute. But for those that might want to come to this concert that aren't as embedded in the jazz world, can you give us a little sense of what they're going to get to experience?
It's going to be a kaleidoscope of music, not just swinging straight ahead jazz, but we also, because of the environment we grew up in, we both have kind of taken from that, the mm-hmm. beautiful Pacific Northwest coast. A lot of that is influenced in our music. And there's just a whole array of sounds and colors. Christine will play, I will play, I will conduct, she will conduct, and it's mostly our own music.
So growing up in Western Canada, this connection with the natural world, how you express that in your music too, right?
Yeah, it definitely comes out in a kind of a canvas of events from memories that really affect us from the beautiful landscape around us that we grew up in.
As well as the swinging piano of Oscar Peterson that Mother had on the stereo when we were kids.
Oh, so you grew up listening to big band and jazz.
Yeah. A lot of singers, Rosemary Clooney, a lot of Ella Fitzgerald, and a lot of Louis Armstrong.
Really? And so this came naturally? You just had this music around you all your life?
Definitely. I think our first play toy was really the piano, just tinkling out little ideas and melodies and finding our way through tunes.
Uh-huh.
And then we just had great band programs. We had incredible band teachers who didn't just say, okay, here's band, now it's over. It was more like, here's some music now. Take this with you on your bus ride home as you look at the big cedar trees on the bus, or you see the ocean coming over as you come over the crest of the hill.
That's a big difference between the U.S. and Canada, where I think we have to fight for funds for music and art education in the schools. Do you notice that when you tour the States?
Well, there's a wave of it falling apart in Canada, too. But
really?
It's getting better again, thanks to our new prime minister. And but yeah, it's true. In the States, it's really weird for me that there's not that deep appreciation that there is in other countries of the music that comes from here.
Yeah, America's classical music.
It's the American
music.
It's really genre, weird. Yeah. The American form of music. And do you have young girls come up to you, or do you inspire young musicians, especially the girls?
Definitely. I mean, every concert we do or clinic or whatever outreach we're doing, the girls are, I think they're inspired by just knowing that this is in front of them. You
in
can
fact,
do it.
I just want to add really quickly, if there's any parents listening, I've even noticed that parents have been bringing their 5 and 6 year olds to my concerts lately, and they love it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like that little. We both have little kids, and we just take it for granted that they hang in and listen to the music. But actually, I'm noticing that this music appeals because we're doing colors and creating electronic sounds with animal sounds of whales and things. So,
At what age were you when you first picked up an instrument?
I was probably 11.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. How about you?
We both started piano really young, and I I thought the piano was everything for me till I was about 11, and then I got a saxophone. So the same thing, the band program kind of switched me. I really did want to be Oscar Peterson, and then I realized...
Really? He was an idol?
I just got so tied up in how technically amazing he was. I felt like, well, that personal voice is explored on the piano so well, I'm going to try to make my own sounds on a different instrument.
And you stuck with it. A lot of kids pick up an instrument, but they don't keep playing. You guys kept playing.
Yeah, I kind of sucked at everything else in life. So it was, and I actually really sucked at the trumpet. I was not a good trumpet player, but I had all the sound in my head from the music. So I eventually had good teachers, and now I feel like I've evolved.
Yeah.
A little.
That's a good answer.
But Christine played piano and saxophone when she was coming up. And I don't know. Do you want to talk about that?
I just think in general, there's going to be a teacher. If you keep at it, there's teachers. Maybe you're lucky and you get them at the beginning, but eventually someone will affect you and make something click. And then you're like, oh my God, this is so fun. Mm-hmm. And it's not always in front of you.
Well, we have a little music now.
She's got the Flurry CD on.
This is the Jensen Sisters. We're going to close the show with some of their incredible music, Christine and Ingrid Jensen. You can go see them Thursday night at UNF's Robinson Theater, where there's an incredible jazz and music program. It's a delight to meet you both, and have a great show. We really appreciate you being with us.
Thanks for having us. The band sounds amazing, so come on out.
Yes.
It's the Jensen Sisters.
Robinson Theater.
Thank you so
Thursday
much.
Thursday night at UNF. Thank you, and that is our show. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Let's take a listen to some jazz. It's the Jensen Sisters. Enjoy the music.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.